And good morning. My name is Per Fogreng with another episode of Fight the Empire. And our guest is Lisa Pease, who is an information activist and author and editor, and who's written a very interesting article for Consortium News, which is entitled, Can Obama Face the Unspeakable? Lisa, good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, good morning. Always good to be here.
Yes. Well, why don't we start out with... What is the unspeakable?
I take that from the title of Jim Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable. And in it, he uses Thomas Merton, a Catholic monk, who described the unspeakable as that evil that we kind of can't face, the really dark evil that assassinates world leaders and changes things for the worse. And the book that Douglas wrote talks about JFK's own confrontations with that unspeakable evil. And as I read that book, I saw so many parallels to what is going on today and the conflicts that Obama is facing, you know, especially with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's very similar when Kennedy took office. He had, you know, the wars in Laos and Vietnam, just as we had Iraq and Afghanistan. And Kennedy, you know, one of the first things he did was get us out of Laos, and he did it by essentially declaring neutrality, you know, no win, no loss, you know, kind of a no-fight zone, and he managed to extricate us from that conflict. But like Obama, I think Kennedy at first believed Vietnam was a necessary war, that we had to do something about it. And most people, I think, don't realize there wasn't like a full-out American involvement at the time that Kennedy took over. There were a lot of American advisors. There weren't a lot of just soldiers firing on the ground. That's not the situation. That really didn't happen until Lyndon Johnson took office. Mm-hmm. Then the troops just escalated, and the deaths and the destruction really escalated. But at the time, you know, that Kennedy was there, he was trying to find a way out of Vietnam, even as his public statements were always, we have to stay the course, we're going to see this through. But privately, he told friends, he told people on the Hill, he told quite a lot of people that, you know, he was looking for a way out, and he didn't feel he could get out before he was reelected, because if he announced it before he was reelected, he wouldn't be reelected. And he also knew that none of the people running against him would do it. So he really had to sit on that until his second term, and that's when he'd planned to withdraw. And, you know, I don't know what Obama's reasoning is for escalating the troops in Afghanistan. I mean, I heard what he said, and I feel like it's not the full story. And I know that other bloggers who sat in on, you know, media calls with the White House say it's more about loose nukes in Pakistan, and I'm like, and why are we sending people into Afghanistan if we're trying to fight loose nukes in Pakistan? Can that even be done with troops? You know, isn't that something you do with intelligence operations? I mean, as frustrated as I am by a lot of things that the CIA and other agencies of the government has done, there does seem to be a use for them in very small strategic operations like that.
How many troops did Kennedy... How many troops were there in Vietnam then? Somehow the number 50,000 sticks in my mind, but that may be wrong.
Yeah, that's funny because the number 5,000 sticks in my mind, but 50,000 is probably closer to the truth, but the number 5 is vivid in my mind. I don't have that handy. That's why I like to write, because I can stop and check and look things up and verify.
Now, he was planning, in fact, he was planning on withdrawing these troops, and then after the assassination, didn't Lyndon Johnson reverse that order?
Right. NSAM, I believe, 263, a National Security Action Memorandum. Now, there are various interpretations of that seem, that seem contradictory, that I think are not contradictory. You know, there are some who say, well, that was just Kennedy drawing down one level of troops so he could escalate another. And that, I don't think that's true. You know, I do think that Kennedy was trying to pull troops out and saw this as a first step. But I also think it's possible Kennedy might have, you know, allowed for the increase of certain troops again for a limited time, but it's very clear that his ultimate goal was to get us out of Vietnam and not to further escalate. So a lot of people don't realize Kennedy had visited Vietnam in the 50s when the French were fighting there,
mm-hmm.
and he had talked to world leaders along the way. He had stopped and visited with Nehru in India and other people around the globe, and he saw right away that it wasn't about communism. It was about nativism, that these people just wanted the right to rule their own country, and that no foreign power was ever going to totally take over that country, not the communists, not the capitalists. So he knew from kind of firsthand battleground experience, having witnessed the situation himself, what a problem it was. And Kennedy was very smart in the way he went about preparing for the withdrawal. He ordered an extensive review. You know, he sent Taylor and others to review.
That's General Maxwell Taylor.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
To write a report. He already told them basically what he wanted to see in the report, but mm-hmm. he needed the background so he could go to the Joint Chiefs and say, hey, this isn't just my opinion. This is what the facts on the ground are showing us. And they did, and they wrote the report, and they verified all his assumptions, basically, and came back. And, of course, the Joint Chiefs saw this as, you know, to them, this is the military mindset. Withdrawal is defeat. You leave with victory or you don't leave.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I feel that mindset is still very much at work here. And to me, that is the unspeakable, that hold that we must conquer, we must kill and destroy in order to get what we want. And to me, it's like, God, we've been on this planet how many years? You know, we're several thousand years old now, you know,
mm-hmm.
several million, depending on how you want to, you know, calculate from what point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just shocking to me that our only choice seems to be to kill somebody to get what we want. When we face each other on a daily basis, when we have wars at work, you know, we don't pull out guns to settle our differences.
Well, you know, that's kind of the history of the United States right from the beginning. You know, during the American Revolution, one of the colonists' grievances was that the Brits wouldn't let them cross the mountains into Indian territory.
Right.
And then, you know, there was just this westward expansion and everything, and then overseas. So it's like we went from being 13 colonies on the Atlantic seaboard to you know, this global power with something like 850 bases around the world, you know.
Right. And I think part of the problem is, you know, this kind of extreme form of patriotism saying we are the best, we know the best, therefore everybody should want to be conquered by us.
Well, you know, there's this, do you see a kind of a warrior culture springing up? This is something, it seems to me, I don't think we used to have that. Back in the Second World War days, you know, the idea was that these were guys from all over the country got drafted to fight the Nazis, you know. They didn't really want to be soldiers, but they had to do their job, you know, and then they were ready to go back to civilian life. But now there's this kind of warrior mentality.
Well, and I can't help but wonder how much video games contribute to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This sense of, you know, and the films, you know, blow them up, shoot them up. And these films always tend to make a lot of money. And there, I read an article recently from somewhere in the UK, I don't remember which paper, talking about what's wrong with America. It's like they seem to just want to kill, kill, kill all the time. And they were commenting that this seemed to be a new phenomenon. So I do think you're onto something there. And I blame, you know, the killing of the fairness doctrine, which gave rise to hate radio.
Mm-hmm.
Before somebody like Rush Limbaugh couldn't be on the air unchallenged, there would have been some counterpoint from an opposing viewpoint, thanks to the fairness doctrine. And now, you know, people can just spew hate and vile and calls to violence and calls to kill people. I mean, can't believe Glenn Beck is still on the air when he's joking about poisoning Nancy Pelosi. I mean,
oh my.
Hate breeds violence. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the more hate you put into the society, the more violence is going to come back out of it. And I think on one hand, that's deliberate. I think there are people who want to see us be more violent and belligerent on the planet. I think that's a horrible, I think that endangers all of us. I think that is a bigger threat and a bigger cause of terrorism than any other thing that we could be doing.
It's, mm-hmm.
That's what's so frustrating about Obama. A lot of us know that he understands this. He knows this viscerally, why they hate us. and why, you know, we are at threat of terrorism. It's because we have been terrorists around the world. And the few times he's actually said something like that, he was the first president to actually acknowledge that we overthrew the government of Iran. It's obviously an open secret and well-established and long-published, but no president has ever said that before. Mm-hmm. He said that in his speech to the Muslim community, you know, right after taking office. And I thought that was a big step forward, acknowledging that, you know, if we continue these kind of imperialist policies, they're going to come back at us.
Yeah, they have consequences. Well, let's get back to President Kennedy's confrontations with the warriors, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right, headed by Curtis LeMay,
Curtis LeMay and Lemnitzer.
Okay.
There were a couple of kind of almost crazies.
They were,
you know,
yes.
The film Dr. Strangelove was based on some of those characters, because mm-hmm. they were so extreme, as was the film 7 Days in May. That was loosely based on Curtis LeMay.
Uh-huh. Well, his first confrontation then had to do with the Bay of Pigs, which he inherited from President Eisenhower.
Right, and that's the key point. He inherited this. This literally happened in his first 100 days. Again, mm-hmm. people who don't know the history, they think, oh, Kennedy made this horrible mistake and he should have known better. How could he have known better? He had only just taken office in, you know, March, and here it is April, you know, and I'm sorry, he had taken office in January, but still, like I said, in the first 100 days.
Mm-hmm.
Still ramping up, trying to figure out what's going on, and the CIA comes to him and says, this is a going concern, you know, we've already had this in the works, it's going to succeed, that's what they told him. And Douglas, in his book, JFK and the Unspeakable, brings forth evidence I had never seen, and I've read a lot about the Bay of Pigs, and there were things I did not know, but had always suspected. I always suspected the CIA had to know this would fail, because they're and unlike the portrait they like to paint of themselves, they are not a bunch of bumbling idiots. These are extremely cool, calculating minds that know exactly what they're doing. And they knew the operation was going to fail. They kind of planned for it to fail, mm-hmm. knowing that then Kennedy would be forced to send in the military. And they knew they couldn't take Cuba back just with a bunch of activists and a little Lanny at the Bay of Pigs. They definitely designed it to fail. And then, you know, figured that Kennedy, being a new president, being a, you know, kind of a Cold Warrior himself, and, you know, certainly not wanting to lose face that early in his administration, would authorize the military, because that's the one thing the CIA couldn't do. CIA couldn't send in the troops. They needed a president to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, you know, he was one of them in the sense that he was from the upper class. He was part of the establishment. You know, he was a privileged, rich guy. What did he care about a bunch of Cubans over there? But, you know, he surprised them all, because he was adamant that the military not be involved, that if this was a native uprising, fine, we'll support them, but we're not going to go in and take back Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really shocked. And it's funny, because the CIA had actually run a psychological profile on Kennedy when he took office, because they wanted to find the best ways to influence him, you know, which again makes you wonder what they've done with Obama. But
yeah.
this is how these guys work, and it should be shocking for people to hear this if they don't already know this history, to think mm-hmm. that an unelected group of people in the CIA were trying to overthrow the will of the American people. We'd elected John Kennedy, you know, to be John Kennedy, not to be the CIA's puppet.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, we should know.
So Kennedy faced the unspeakable, you know, right away, essentially, and he made the right choice. He mm-hmm. really made the right choice not to escalate. That was absolutely the right thing. We had no business being in there in the first place. He made the wrong choice to even approve the operation, but it's understandable how, again, a young green president who believes this is vital concern and that the previous president had approved it, you know, obviously there's some merit to it. And after that, his eyes were wide open. I mm-hmm. almost wish Obama had had that kind of an experience early on, because I think he would be trusting a different set of people mm-hmm. right now.
Well, this is Fight the Empire, and we are speaking with Lisa Pease, an information activist and writer, and talking about an article she wrote called Can Obama Face the Unspeakable? And it's about a very interesting book called JFK and the Unspeakable. I believe one of our people here at KABU interviewed the author of that book, James Douglas.
Yeah, very likely. He's done quite a number of interviews. I told him I was going to be on the air. I said, they should be talking to you. He goes, oh, I've talked to everybody. You should talk to them.
Well, it's interesting, the connections with Obama. Now, the second confrontation that Kennedy had was with the had to do with the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right. Right. And again, a lot of people don't realize that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, pretty much all the Joint Chiefs of Staff were adamant that we should do a full-out invasion of Cuba, that we should do the airstrikes, take out, you know, some of the missiles, and then go in and, you know, wipe out the missile bases from the ground. And again, Kennedy saw that this could, you know, this was not an acceptable option and would very likely lead to nuclear war. He's like, well, what's Russia going to do? And you know, LeMay and Lemnitzer are like, well, nothing. You know, they're not going to react. And Kennedy's like, of course they're going to react.
Well, they were ready to bomb Moscow, weren't they?
Pardon?
Weren't the Joint Chiefs? They were ready to bomb Moscow.
Oh, yeah, they were ready for a first strike on the Soviet Union. I mean, there was such a mentality at that time, and it's probably hard for younger people to understand that there were really people in this country who felt like the Soviet Union was practically hovering over America. I mean, literally with Sputnik, you know, it was like hovering over us, ready to devour us at any moment. And Kennedy knew that just wasn't true, that a lot of that was, you know, just hype and BS. And Kennedy had his own back channel to Khrushchev. Khrushchev had actually sent him a letter which was smuggled by one of Khrushchev's agents in America in a little newspaper to Pierre Salinger, who was JFK's press secretary here. And, you know, they had their little form of communication. And in that letter, Khrushchev said something about, he used an allusion to the Ark, Noah's Ark, and how the clean and the unclean, you know, were together on the same boat. And Kennedy knew instantly what he was trying to say. And he's like, yes, and it doesn't matter who, you know, who we think is clean or unclean. The important thing is for the Ark to continue on its journey.
You know, it's interesting that Kennedy had to resort to these kind of back channels.
Right. Well, if they went through official channels, then their intelligence services on both sides would hear everything and try and sabotage it. And Kennedy, at one point, he actually pulled a congressman out into the Rose Garden because he thought it might be the one place the CIA hadn't bugged in the White House. Now, how sad is that when a president has to avoid, you know, his own intelligence agency's bugs? And when people say the CIA isn't a rogue intelligence agency, well, it definitely, they were a rogue intelligence agency under the Kennedy administration. They were doing their own operations, and even in the Bay of Pigs, if Kennedy had not authorized the invasion, the CIA had a plan to send the Cubans in anyway and then beg for American help, you know, as if they had gone off on their own. And, you know, so they were running policy, and Kennedy was running around trying to stop them and trying to find ways to destroy them. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, here we are at the sensitive, literally we were at the brink of nuclear war. I mean, it is not an exaggeration to say that. Because Khrushchev didn't want it either, but he had his own right-wing advisors, just like Kennedy did, who wanted to, you know, strike America just as badly as we wanted to strike Russia. I mean, it was really a horrible, tense moment there for, you know, a few days for the entire planet, because that could not have ended well. And Kennedy and his brother Robert were literally the only two standing up to the rest of their top officials, saying, no, we can't do this, no. And fortunately, you know, Khrushchev and Bobby kind of saw a way out. Khrushchev had sent one letter and saying, you know, if you promise never to invade Cuba again, we'll withdraw our missiles, and, you know, and they had floated the notion that we would withdraw our missiles from Turkey, and Khrushchev appeared to accept that, and then hours later, a second letter came where Khrushchev appeared not to accept that, and Bobby Kennedy said, let's answer the first letter and ignore the second letter, and that's kind of how we got out of that mess. But again, it was a case where Kennedy had to be incredibly strong and brave. And he had told friends, the film 7 Days in May, for people who don't know, is about a military guy essentially taking control of the government and trying to overthrow the president and almost succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And Kennedy had been asked, do you think that's possible in this country? And he said, well, actually, I do think it's possible. He said, if a young president were to come in and to have kind of a Bay of Pigs sort of failure, and then were to have maybe two more like that, then, yeah, I think mm-hmm. the military would overthrow the president. And so Kennedy kind of had his two, because he, you know, he failed to invade Cuba after the Bay of Pigs. He failed to invade Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis, failed, mm-hmm. you know, in their terms. And then, of course, he failed to escalate the war in Vietnam.
Right, that's the third strike. Well, you know, you were talking about this sort of warrior mindset that was. I remember back in around 1950, Collier's Magazine, which is a big magazine in those days, I think they had a whole issue devoted to a war with the Soviet Union.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was like Boy, it might be a collector's item now if you ever see it in an old magazine store or something.
Yeah, that's worth finding. I like to see that.
Yeah, well, I think it came out around 1949, Collier's Magazine, which no longer exists, but they had a...
I will look for that, because, yeah, it just strikes me looking at the 50s, because, yeah, World War II, you know, was fought against the Nazis, not the communists, you know, mm-hmm. and yet by the end of the war, it was all about the communists. And really, what I've come to understand is that they realized that the Soviet Union was powerful and was going to grab up a lot of important resources, minerals, oil, whatever. They were making grabs all over the world for resources so that they could control them. And the, you know, Americans wanted to, one, stop that, and two, it's like, hey, that's a good idea. We should be grabbing those resources.
Well, the Soviet Union was actually sitting on a lot of it, because they were in this sort of Eurasian heartland, which was, this is a lot of our foreign policy people talk about. Whoever rules this Asian heartland kind of rules the world. And one of Kissinger's nightmares was that China and the Soviet Union might get together. And so, and now they sort of are. And so let's go on to Obama. So here is Obama. You know, he's faced with these, the military, the generals and everything. And he's, so far, looks like he's going along with them. 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan.
Well, and I think Obama, I fear he may be a little naive. You know, he said, we've got this, 1.5 years and then we're out. And I just know that things don't ever go as planned. And mm-hmm. I know the military will come back to him in 1.5 years and say, we can't leave. This is happening. This is happening. If we stay 2 more years, we can fix all of this. You know, or even if we stay 6 more months, and then 6 more months after that, and 6 more months after that. I mean, you know, he promised us an end to the war in Iraq, but we still have troops there. And, you know, when will they really be out? When will they be home? And when will we not, have bases there? To me, that's what the end of war means, is that we really pull out. And that has not historically been the case. When America's gone, in and fought on land, we've always left military bases behind. And how is that not like an empire staking out territory? I don't understand why. And how is this not one of the reasons we can't get health care? We can't afford to maintain all these bases in all these countries all over mm-hmm. the world and get health care for our citizens at home. And I think if people understood that the choice is that stark, you get one or the other, you can't have both, I think a lot of people would rather have health care.
Well, or just, free education. We see what's happening in California right now. What do? They up the tuition? I don't know how many...
Yeah, I think it went up by, and again, if I say a number, my phone is acting weird. Hold on for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. I think the battery was dying on that one.
Oh, no.
the University of California system just had a huge tuition hike, and there were protests all over campus, and I was looking at that a little bit, too, and it wasn't that long ago when tuition was free.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
Yeah, and again, it's about who we are as a society. If we value warfare above all else, then everything else suffers. We can't buy anything else. We can't afford anything else. If instead we give up warfare, then we can buy public education, and we can, have a strong public media service, and we can have health care, and we can have all these things that are important to us. But people don't think of the trade-off. They get caught up in that kind of America first jingoistic mindset, and we have to conquer. And I would say it's a very male mindset, except that it's not. I know a lot of women who feel that way too.
Mm-hmm.
it's just scary. It's certainly a very right-wing mindset, which I don't share. And I am not, you know, a complete pacifist, although I would like to be. But I think in very small, limited cases, again, you know, I think we were right to join in World War II. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would have sat by and let Hitler stomp all over Europe and kill all the Jews. I think that was a horrible, horrible thing that was well worth going in to fight. But frankly, I haven't seen a conflict since then that has been so clear-cut. Supposedly we're in Afghanistan, they say, because of 9/11. But, of course, they use that excuse in Iraq. And as I recall, it was a bunch of Saudis, not Afghanistan, who were supposedly on those planes.
Well, what a lot of people don't know is that the Taliban, after 9/11, they had offered to either put bin Laden on trial in Afghanistan or turn him over to some kind of international court. And they just wanted to see the evidence against him, and the U.S. Wouldn't even deal with that at all. I mean, they wouldn't respond to that offer. And apparently the U.S. had, even before 9/11, had planned to invade Afghanistan. This is according to a Pakistani diplomat.
Right, right. No, and in fact, I believe it was UNICAL was really in deep talks in Afghanistan trying to get a pipeline going through there.
Mm-hmm.
Afghanistan doesn't have a lot of natural resources of its own, but it's a central crossing point from one country.
Further north, there's a lot of resources. It's very interesting. Just recently, the Chinese, they're building a pipeline, I think, to that very area in Central Asia, so it might make this pipeline that we want kind of a moot point, you know?
Right. And again, that's, I think, what people need to understand. It's like, it's never about the cause they tell us.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've come to understand. Like I said, since World War II, I just don't feel that's been the case. I feel like all of these wars, these little conflicts, have really been about something else. It's been about a pipeline or an oil field or a diamond mine or, you know, mm-hmm. a gold, you know, region. There's so much that goes on under the hood that's never openly discussed, because if it were, there would be no support for going to war. Or I hope. I mean, that's my fear, is that actually there would still be support for going to war. Hey, if there are resources out there, let's go get them. We're Americans. We deserve it, you know?
Well, we got about a minute left. Do you think Obama might have some moment of truth? Or what?
Well, I do think Kennedy learned very quickly in office, and Obama has the capacity to learn. I think he has a certain fortitude of character. I would like to think, you know, I very much want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but I need to see something in the next 12 months, because if not, you know, wow, I'm going to be looking at primary challengers. And this mm-hmm. is from somebody who worked her butt off to get Obama elected. And, you know, I know he's up against a lot. I know it's difficult, but he's got to dig deep and find the balls to really confront these people and expose them in the media and go to the press with what's really going on. I mean, that's how you get out of these messes. You tell the public what's going on under the hood, and then the public helps you get what you need to get.
Mm-hmm.
And if he tries to fight this alone and in secret, it's not going to work.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, we've been talking with Lisa Peace, who is a information activist and author who has written a very interesting article on Can Obama Face the Unspeakable? Well, we hope he can. We will have to stay tuned and find out. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And this is Per Fogring of Fight the Empire, and stay tuned to KABU. Always something good on KABU.